This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. It's your boy, Michael Cruz Kane, back again with another episode of A Good Cry. Folks, we are like a trillion episodes in. We are almost at the end of season one. And I just wanted to say thank you so much to everyone who has listened, subscribed and shared and rated and reviewed, but especially the people who have come to see the live shows, who have talked to me afterwards, who have said how much the podcast means to them, and also the people who have messaged me saying, you know, here's some topics I think you should cover, here are some guests I think you should have, here's some questions you could ask, or even just sharing some comment or thought without asking anything of me at all. I love you. Thank you so much for doing that. This season has been transformative and beautiful to me, and I'm glad that it's meant something to some of you as well. So thank you. And I know I'm behind on responding to messages. I'm very behind, like 4 months. But I swear, in the hiatus between seasons, I will get to every single email. I swear it. Everyone. Each and every one. Grief thought for the week. Have you all ever heard the song Supper Time by Irving Berlin? The most famous version of it is probably Ella Fitzgerald's. That's definitely the most famous version of it. And it's a beautiful song about a woman who has to serve supper to her kids, even though her husband or her boyfriend, the father of the kids, is not ever coming home again. And it's something we talk about a lot on this episode with Shane Torres. There are times when you have to get up off the mat. Life is forcing you to move through the grief with rituals and appointments and busy work that needs to get done because the world does not stop turning. As horrible as that may sound, it can also be a gift that you have some responsibilities that need to be taken care of, so you can't stay indefinitely in what feels like bottomless grief. This episode with Shane Torres, we talk about a lot of stuff, the loss of his parents, how he uses comedy to address a lot of the issues surrounding grief and death. Shane is an amazing person, a tremendous comedian. He's someone who, even though I had barely known him at all, gave me a lot of advice before the first time I ever did stand up on TV. And I'm always going to be grateful to him for it. He's very revealing and open and vulnerable in this episode. And I'm so grateful to him for doing it. This is Shane Torres on A Good Cry. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
The way we kick it off is by asking, how would you describe your relationship with grief?
Oh, it's complex, I guess, like everyone's. Never solved is what I would say.
Gotcha. Like no sense of resolution.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would say you think you make advances with it and come to terms with certain things you grieve. And sometimes you do, and then sometimes you're like, I guess I didn't, because I'm crying because I saw a fucking kitty litter commercial.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Is kitty, now, you, was that just a random example of a thing, or do kitty little commercials?
That's a random.
Okay.
I really don't like cats, so it's probably has nothing. Yeah.
Sometimes I will like spiral based on something that seems completely unrelated. I'll be listening to the radio and some song that has nothing to do with my son comes on and I'm like, whoops. And now I'm crying about this.
At certain times I can be pretty easily manipulated by commerce.
What was your first experience with grief?
Probably a pet or something, you know? Yeah, I would say probably a dog that I recall. We buried our dog when I was like 11 or 12, probably. Maybe Tom, maybe younger. I don't know, honestly. Probably earlier than that. But
like, and was that something that like had a significant impact on you as a kid? Or I know like some people who have dogs are very, very close with them, and other people who are like, well, the dog died, let's get a new dog.
No, I get, now that I think about it, when I was in third grade, we had an assembly outside of the school, and there was like our high school band, I think, was playing or something like that, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And then my second grade teacher, who I really liked, keeled over and had a stroke.
Oh, wow.
In front of like the whole student body. Yeah. And she was a pretty nice lady, what I remember. But she was like old then. I remember the school called that night and they were like, yeah, she died. It was an elementary school, you know, they were like, well, we should probably tell these parents that like we didn't. But then the care flight came in and everything. So I remember that being pretty resonating a lot when I was in it. Because I remember I cried a lot and stuff. And I was like, people cry. You know, when you're 7, you cry. Or however old I was.
Yeah. Was it something that someone tried to frame for you, as you recall? Or was it just like a thing that happened and then like you went to school the next day?
Happened, went to school the next day. I don't remember a big deal being made out of it outside of me being 8 years old and kind of, I guess, in a little bit of shock from it or something like that.
I think, like, you know, before tragedy struck close to me, I think when I was a kid, there were always, like, people who died that I knew them, but it felt like someone, it didn't feel like someone in my life. Like, my, like, sort of momentum of life just kind of kept going.
Yeah, that's, that, you could say that about this death. I think it was like kind of, a little, you would call it peripheral or whatever, even though it happened right in front of me and 200 other kids.
It's kind of amazing how close that stuff can be to you. And you're still just like, okay, well, I got homework I got to do. And I know I was going to go over to Jimmy's house later.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like I would think that death or grief, you know, like eventually you still kind of have to like, the world doesn't stop turning. So like, no matter like who it is and how important it is to you, you either get the lead out of your ass or you don't.
Right.
Yeah. Like it doesn't, I mean, it's not to say that it doesn't matter, but it's, you have other obligations and other things to take right. care of. So like, you know, even at 8, you know, it's like, I probably had a fucking science project due or something.
Right. I got this diorama I have to finish. So I'm going to take 5 minutes to be weirded out about this. And then I get the Play-Doh together.
Yeah. You know, and it serves as a distraction or whatever, you know.
And then as you've gotten older, you've had other experiences with grief, right? Like, I know I've seen you've done comedy about your dad.
Yeah.
How long ago did your dad die?
Probably 10 years now, 11 years maybe.
What did he die from?
He had a stroke. He was, it didn't kill him, but he was brain dead. So, you know, like he wasn't coming back. He was gone. So we let him go. So we guess technically he died in hospice or whatever, but he was a vegetable, or he was going to be. He wasn't in great health before, but yeah, there wasn't even a way remotely for him to have kind of resembled the same person from what the doctors were saying.
And you said he had health problems before. Was his...
Yeah, he's just like kind of like, I guess, what was sedentary person. So like, you know, like old guy, he was in his 60s. So like just a bit overweight. He's had some heart attacks. He was diabetic, you know, so like all of that, I'm sure played into it, you know, and then stress and whatever other shit he might have had going on in his head. But I don't really know too much about that. Yeah. So like I would say, you know, probably 10 or 11 years now he's been gone.
And he had multiple heart attacks before he had the stroke, you said?
Yeah. But like years before they didn't like immediately precede it.
Got it. And with stuff like that, I could see a bunch of different ways of feeling about that, right? Like if your dad has a couple heart attacks, but comes out of it basically fine, I could see you being like, well, my dad's invincible. Or I could see you being like, he's had a couple heart attacks. Like anything can happen. Did you have one of those two points of view before or something in the middle?
Ooh, I guess, you know, I would assume this isn't too much of a abnormality, but like, you know, like the first time something like that happens, you're very scared. And then if it happens a couple other times and they make it through these things, you know, these scares or whatever.
Yeah.
You're kind of like, oh, he'll be okay. You know, like eventually, like, you know, like this is just his health and the way he lives, you know, and then he had a stroke, which he'd never had before. And it fucking killed him. I was living in Portland at the time. I had to fly home. That's pretty much, I mean, like it, like I got home and then he, I got to the hospital. He was still alive for a few days.
And were you there? Who else was there in the hospital with you?
Family, brothers. My grandmother was there, aunt and an uncle and my mom and my stepmother.
And was it the kind of thing where like everybody comes to a decision together on how his care is going to proceed?
Well, you know, it's not up to everybody in those situations. Like usually one person has control of these situations. My mother was a nurse and my stepmother was a nurse. And we all sat down with the doctor. I think there were 7 of us. Maybe. I do remember my dad's best friend was there. This guy, Bill. And we were all talking about like, do we keep him alive or not? Blah, blah. Just the fuck, you know exactly what the conversation is. And they were like, it's not a way for people to live. And my mom said something about like, when we were a lot, when he was married to me, blah, blah, blah. He wouldn't want to, same thing with my stepmother. Other people had different opinions. And then my dad's best friend, Bill, who stood up and he was like, I know Simon Woodward would be some goddamn vegetable. So rednecks are good in certain situations.
the clarity.
Bring relief to the room. Yeah. And then, you know, like it was very like, you know, it sucks, but the vibe of it is very much. It's so funny as later Bill like ended up dating my stepmother, my dad, you know, the widow, my father's widow. And then I think he gave her like syphilis or something.
Oh, no, that's not how I wanted that story to end.
Yeah, well, it's fucking have a sunnier subject for your podcast.
Yeah, right, it's true. My fault.
Yeah. After that, like, yeah. So we decided like everybody got on the same page eventually is what I remember. Some people were just like, you know, when it comes to grief and it comes to a situation like that, where someone's not necessarily going to die, but they're not going to be the same person. A lot of people's well-intended emotions get in the way of like, you're not giving him a chance and these kind of things. It's like, you know, like there's a little bit of heart before mind, I guess is what I would say. And you know, like before practicality. So everyone finally got on the page and they were kind of less reactive and eventually more practical, which is the way you have to be eventually. Because it's an insane situation. So practicality is what you need to like solve these problems and move forward.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Like you definitely need, because there's so much logistics, right? Too, like about.
Well, yeah, there's a ton of shit like that. But it's also like, I'm talking like if you and I are trying to keep one, you want one person to stay alive and they've had a stroke and I don't because I think it's not a way to live. It might be because, you know, like you're not processing as fast as I am, or maybe I'm processing too quickly for that matter. You know, like maybe I'm not ready to deal with it. So like, there's a lot of, I think it's a lot of it just based out of emotion, even when you're being cracked.
Right.
Like you're not ready to say goodbye to someone. And I'm like, maybe I'm not ready to deal with the grief, but I am ready to recognize the reality of the situation, but I might not be emotionally ready to say goodbye. But.
And do you remember, like, I assume that the way you feel has evolved in some way over the last decade. Do you remember, like, initially the first time that you felt, like, the weight of your dad's death? Was it when you got the phone call? Was it seeing him?
I mean, I guess I knew it right away. When my mom was a nurse, and she's a really practical person, you know, like, so she was, like, she was very much in the thought of, like, we sat down one night, and she was, like, look, I've seen this before. I know how this goes. Your father is not going to be a person. You're not going to have a relationship with him after, you know, like not that blunt, but very much saying the reality of the situation is he's already dead. He's just breathing is more or less what was going on. So I guess then, but then I remember we moved him to hospice and I had to, I was the only one there at the moment. And the nurse came in and asked me to sign the papers that like legally would allow them to like, you know, whatever, you know, like people came. I didn't mean to make it sound like I was the only one there. That's not true at all. But like, I was the only one there at this particular moment in time. And a nurse came and was like, hey, will you sign these papers, Shane? And I was like, oh, and I didn't know if I could. So I called my mother. So I guess that was probably the moment where like, I kind of buckled and it hit me.
And when you say you buckled, you mean like you had like an emotional breakdown?
I wouldn't call it a breakdown, but it was like, this is really hard. And that was kind of like, that was kind of the button on the moment that I guess like I was like, I'm sad and I cry or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like that also is very relatable that like the.
Yeah. It was a big moment. It was a hard moment. Yeah.
And also those pieces where like something happens, like signing the papers, something happens. That's like.
Well, that's very. Yeah. Yeah. There's like, it's those moments can be very vivid as opposed. You wonder where the hours went in these situations that you spend in days you spend in these situations, like in a hospital room or. You know, caring for someone at home or wherever, if it's a prolonged death of any kind, you wonder where the hours went with it. But then you have these like, I get these little fucking, you almost call them like Easter egg moments of like, I remember this vivid, like you have these moments of vivid clarity. But then you have like 23 and a half hours of nothing but gray matter in your fucking face. There's no, it's all white noise, you know, like, because, you know, as great as some doctors and nurses are, they don't just have answers for you. They would love to give them if they could, but they don't. So everything takes time.
Yeah. And also, I don't know what your experience was like, but when we were in the hospital, the doctors, we love the doctors, we love the nurses, but especially the doctors, it's like, okay, well, now they have other patients too.
Well, you know, like, it's like, odds are if you're in a hospital and you're saying, you know, someone has passed, like, you lose someone in a hospital, hey, fucking sorry, you're not the only one here that today that has had someone die.
Yeah.
Like, that's it sucks, but it's a fucking brutal place. This guy's got to go, this doctor, this nurse has to go on to the next person and, like, change their catheter and wipe their ass, you know, like, I think a lot of people try to give good care, but they're also fucking, they're stretched thinner than a piece of wet toilet paper. So.
Yeah. What was your relationship like with your dad?
Up and down, I guess. Like, I think the best way I could describe it would be, my father was a good guy, but he had a lot of trouble meeting his responsibilities as a father. So I would say my relationship was inconsistent.
The way you phrase that sounds like something that you came to, you know what I mean? That, 'cause I could see that idea of, like, you know, having difficulty meeting your obligations or responsibilities as a dad is something that you could hold against someone. But as you become an adult going, oh, you know what? I see how hard life can be now, and understand that you can be a good person in spite of having made whatever errors when I was growing up or whatever.
Yeah. Your relationships with your folks are usually pretty complicated for people, even if they have good ones. So yeah, I would say I definitely came to, like, I never thought he was a bad person, but I knew he came up short in a lot of ways because I saw the effects of it. And eventually on him too, like what it did to his, like, mental wellness and, or whatever the fuck, I hate the word wellness. It's such a pathetic piece of shit. It's fucking just say you're not a doctor and you're giving advice. That's a better way to put it. I still have a lot of baggage with my father, even though I know that, you know, so, like, even though I know he was a good person and he came up short and he had a lot of things that were not easy for him in his life too. To me, this is a simplistic way to put it, but you have to get up off the fucking mat. Like, even if you are down and things aren't going the way you want, some things don't work out and that's okay. But fucking, are you going to get up off your ass or not?
What does that mean to you when you're saying get up off the mat for you? Is that like, go, like, do comedy?
Well, like, my dad had a lot of tough breaks. Like, you know, like, we had a divorce and he had a lot of, like, tough things happen before, but I didn't see him putting a ton of effort into change things like the way you need to make real change. And so to me, self-work is hard. Like, it's very difficult, but fuck you. You have responsibilities to other people. That's what I think, you know, and I know there's things that get, I don't mean to sound insensitive. Some people have issues they don't even know they have, and that's why they can't deal with problems, and that's why they keep making the same mistakes. Fucking, I'm one of those people that I'm trying to. You can provide, or you can do something in some way to be a better version of yourself. Always, even if it's not, even if you can't meet every obligation or responsibility you signed up for intentionally or unintentionally, there's still ways for you to do more than you're doing if you're, like, on a losing streak. And it can be very simple or very easy, but, like, you can't just sit around and wait to fucking die.
What kind of things, what kind of work do you feel like you, like, when you get up off the mat, as you say, is that therapy? Is that working out? Is that doing comedy? Is that telling stories? Like, how do you do, what kind of work do you do?
It's exercises, like, helps me a bit. I work a lot. That's what I like to do. And I don't know if that is actually fixing a problem, but, I don't want to say it. I can be productive in some way and healthy in some way that is, makes my life a little more secure and a little more better. You know, whether it's a spot in the cellar that pays me a few bucks and that makes me happy. Working makes me happy. I value effort, and it's a place where I'm fortunate to have a job and a career where I get to do something I love. And I take it for granted sometimes, like everybody else takes things for granted. So I'm not saying it's always a blessing, but it always feels like a blessing. But, and I hate that I have to qualify every little state because
it's, I do the same thing.
Yeah. And I fucking hate it. I love what I do for work. So that's the place I feel best, is on a stage with a microphone. That's the place I feel good. When my mom died, we had her funeral. I flew back to to New York the next day, and I did a spot that night. So that's where I like to be. Because if I only have to focus on one thing, even if it's just for fucking 5 minutes, it's still pretty. It's better than feeling really bad.
And does that help you, like, getting up and doing comedy, does that help you in a way that it helps you process what you're going through? Or is it like a moment where I can take what I'm going through and kind of push it off to the side and do this other thing that brings me joy and then I'll come back?
Eventually it can lead to process. I think eventually it can lead to process, but at one point I get to push it to the side and just have a relief from it for however long, you know, like, and sometimes longer. Cause I'm also out with friends, you know, like a lot of the time when I'm at these places. So it's a kind of, the relief is nice of not being, you know, like if you're around a fucking hospital bed for a week and a half, hoping someone doesn't die or trying to figure out this whole situation, then a fun indie comedy show in Brooklyn might provide a little bit of relief as opposed to, you know, the beep of a monitor that's getting slower.
Yeah, I always found like those things to be a little hit or miss right off the bat. You said you did a show right after your mom died, right? Because I always found those things to be like, if I'm feeling shitty, that sometimes I would go and do a show and it would make me feel so much better. It would like push it away or help me like move through it for a second. But sometimes it was a thing you were talking about before. I'll go and I'll see everybody just like doing their regular shit. And I'm like, wait, how can I be so sad?
Yeah. Well, what it fixes for me is a place to like feel better from and go to. I know this problem is not fixed.
Right,
I don't mean to say it like that, but like a little break from it is fine. And I also get to feel good about my getting laughs or like something I did or being in a place that I feel familiar and happy. So sometimes you need a little bit of it almost serves as a catalyst to being like, okay, well, tomorrow this is still going to suck. Your dad's still going to be, you know, smothered in earth. And then you know, you still have to deal with it, but at least you got a break for a moment and you feel a little bit better about that. I have something to fucking hold on to.
Yeah.
Or feel a little, that made me feel a little better. You know, it's an ice cream bar or it's a drink.
Yeah, it's like a quick charge a little bit too, right? It's like a little, like, it's like 5 energy points to like help you just like stand up a little taller for a few minutes.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like that a bit, if you have it, you know, like, that's for some people, that's like, in that situation, it's going for a run or knitting or whatever, you know what I mean? Or just turning off. That's what I think. Or that's how I did it.
How long ago did your mom die?
4 years.
Having had the experience of your dad dying, was that very different from your mom? Like, did that have the way you thought about mortality or whatever shifted that it made those experiences different?
Well, they were different for sure. But as far as mortality and grief goes, like, you know, some things are harder than others, but I don't think it changed the way I felt about grief or anything surrounding. I think it's just fucked.
In the time since that, has there been a change in the way you feel? Like, in other words, you described that like having a moment where you buckled with your dad, like with what was going on with your dad. That does that happen less frequently now? Like, or like, what are the ways in which the feelings have evolved since the events?
I guess I don't know how much they've changed. I feel that maybe you get mad.
And where's that anger directed?
It kind of goes everywhere. It's, you know, it's a fucking, it's like a flash grenade of like emotion. You don't, sometimes you have people to blame when you lose somebody, and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you blame the person, and sometimes you have no one to blame, or you blame yourself. But if you don't know what to do, or who to be mad at, or who to ask for answers, then you're like anybody who's lost. You're irritated. If you have no direction to put a feeling, I suppose the best you can do is either figure out where to put it or try and do something. Use it as energy.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
like when those feelings are coming on, anger or like, you know, you feel like abjectly sad, can you feel it coming? Like you're like, oh, I know, I can just tell today's a day where I'm going to have like a, I don't know, an episode or whatever. Because I'll have like a dream or something, you know what I mean? And then wake up and be like, today is going to be a day where this is going to be bad for me.
My mother would say she had dreams about stuff like that, but I don't know. Maybe a little. But I think that's kind of I probably do honestly have like a moment where I know it's coming, or I could speak honestly to say that that's probably true. Like I could feel something, but I would say the fact that I see it coming most of the time prevents me from having a moment.
Is that, and when you say prevents you from having it, is that good? Is it?
I know. Truly.
Yeah. Cause I think like the thesis of this podcast originally, which I don't really know if it's true, is that like, you need to have like moments where you like break down, moments where you get mad, all that stuff to kind of like flush it out, and it can help you feel better afterwards. But I've also talked to people who are like, you know, I don't want to have those. I don't want to like get on my knees in the green room at a comedy show and cry for 5 minutes. I want to hold it together.
I guess what I know are these few things. One, people get to grieve however they want. If there was a right way to do it, people would know how to do it. So, like people could probably, there's unhealthy ways to do it. There's healthy ways to do it, but you come to resolution on your own with those things a lot of the time, or with like, you know, like in time is what I mean to say. Mm-hmm. And two, like for me, keeping it together mostly, like I definitely have had my moments, but trying to keep it together, it's a responsibility. You know, you still have other people you might need to take care of for some people, or other people you need to have in mind, and yourself. So I'd rather not turn into a bucket of tears at a fucking venue before a show. It's for me later if I have it, you know? And I think it's for me to deal with or not deal with. And it's not that I don't appreciate concern or, you know, any of that kind of stuff, because I do greatly, but it's not really anybody else's, there's no way to fix it. So it's not really anybody else's problem. It's nice that people can hurt for you and feel for you, but community helps. And I don't mean to say that it doesn't, but you know, like there's no, it's not a solve. It's therapy, you know, kind of just, it's valuable, but it is not the solution really a lot of the time, at least not in my experience.
Yeah, I think another tough thing about that concern is that, again, speaking for me, when it comes from people who I always appreciate 100% of the time, even when people say the wrong thing or like, you know, he's in a better place or whatever.
It's always it's like well-intended. I agree. Like people's intentions are good and they care. So it's appreciated, and it's appreciated in the moment, but sometimes you just don't want anyone to fucking talk to you.
Yeah. And I think I totally get that. And I also think that if you're talking to people who don't have any idea what it's like, and everybody's thing is different, you know what I mean? But especially like comedy, I mean, you are in like, you know, the Cellar and places where you probably have more established comedians a lot. I do comedy around a lot of young people who like, you know, if they want to ask me about my son dying, it's like it's the furthest experience from their mind possibly. So I appreciate them trying to ask me about it, and I want to talk to them about it and be like, you know, death is a real thing that you will experience. But I know they have no idea what I'm talking about. So it makes it hard sometimes to exploit that concern. To like, that concern can't always help me. Because I'm talking to you in French and you only speak Spanish. There's no way for us to get together on this.
Yeah. It's very strange to, or I say it's very uncommon to find common ground in those moments where somebody can really resonate with you. You know, like if you're so upset, somebody said, like it kind of, they have to say the perfect thing or do the perfect thing. You know, like, and it does happen. You know, there's moments where like, I'm like, I won't forget this guy, or I won't forget that guy, or this woman for this in these moments, because they did the exact right thing, and everybody else tried to.
Right.
But sometimes, you know, like I've said this before, but I think it's. Do you play an instrument?
I went to college to be a singer, so I sing a little bit.
That's true. Yeah. So you know what? There's such a thing as a wrong note.
Yes.
I think in comedy, there is no such thing as a wrong note. There's only the person playing it. So, like, grief is like that, too. You know, some people just can't play you what you want to hear, and then some person does by accident most of the time.
Yeah. I had a thing that I think about like that, when you talk about someone just playing the note that you need. When my son died, he's a twin. So his twin, my other son, lived. And I remember specifically the people who on their first birthday said happy birthday to both of my sons, one of whom was dead. You know, I hadn't like asked anybody to do that.
Yeah.
But I remember like that seems like to me an example of what you're talking about, where it's like someone, a million people has said nice things to me. The people who said that specific thing, I'm like, I'm never going to forget that. I'll never forget the people who did that.
Yeah. I just think sometimes people land the, just they land the plane correctly. I don't know how to say it other than that.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess there's only like so many words, and also none of the words really handle it. Right. Do you feel like you've learned stuff from grief, that it has like changed you in some way? I mean, obviously, you know, the death of your parents is going to change you in some way, but are there ways in which those feelings have made you a different person?
Like I said earlier, it showed me that the world doesn't stop turning. I mean, you must have had this feeling, but it's like, it's horrendous what you went through, but you still have one child that needs everything from you.
Yep.
You have to deal with that. You know, like, they still need you. That's why you have to fucking do whatever you have to do. Like, that's what I mean when the world doesn't stop turning. It's like...
Yeah, no, totally. I understand completely.
Yeah, of course you do. I guess it's like, fucking, lick your wounds, but like, don't sit out too long. It's like, it's easier said than done. And for some people, it's much harder depending on what the loss is. But yeah, that's it. You're not going to feel better if you just sit around and ache. It's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I think having our son survive was a blessing, but it's a blessing specifically in the way that you're talking about. That's like, okay, well, this baby, he needs stuff. You got to feed him. You got to get him clothes. You got to start signing him up for daycare. Now he's getting older. Now you teach him how to play basketball. And there's just like, it's an assignment that has to be done. And that, I mean, it's a sense of purpose. You feel like totally rudderless. This horrible thing has happened. Now here's something that you can do that will maybe, if you do it right, make the world better. And you have to do it right now. And that was a blessing for us.
I guess for me, a lot of the time, grief or anger surrounding like a death or a death of a relationship, even, you know, like anything that's ending. I don't know if this is the healthiest way to do it or not, but like I don't really give a fuck because I think it works for me. It needs to be a motor to like do better and handle things. That can be with yourself too. Like, I guess the thing I take from grief is that, well, it's time to be, you know, it's like to be the man your mother raised you to be. That's like the best way to like handle grief for me, is to show up and take care of my shit.
I mean, in that way, it's like, it sounds like it's like honoring your mom.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. Yeah, you got to be the person they raised you to be, or tried to raise you to be. Yeah, that's what I take. I guess that's what I took from it.
So you're a comedian. You're a tremendously funny, professionally funny person. Were there times in any of this grief, through all of the suffering, that were like that you found funny?
Like, that's the only way I survive through these moments, is typically like laughing in extremely dark moments, you know? I don't know, like maybe it's a little fucked up or inappropriate, but I could give a fuck.
I don't think it is, actually. I think it's like, to me, if I had to guess, because I don't know, I think it happens to every single person. Like, you go through this like protracted sadness, but grief is a thing where like everybody just expects that from, you know, the opening of the movie to the end of the movie, it's all sadness the whole time.
There's great moments of levity because of the contrast, like it creates next to all the grief. Like, my mother was a nurse. She was in the hospital for about a month and a half when she died. But she, my mother was an immigrant. She was from Ireland. And like a lot of her friends were Irish nurses and Scottish and English nurses. They all came over to this town because they needed medical professionals when it was becoming a bigger city, essentially. And then like she's in this hospital. It is, I thought it was very funny. It was like all these old Irish, all these women who had fucking diapered me and like worked in these hospitals were showing up. You know, like all their husbands are dead. They're like, they came to this country together and they're leaving together. It's very, and I found it funny because they were like smoking and drinking and they were talking about like gross kind of, they're like, this is when you fucked your then boyfriend, now husband for the first, like shit like that. It was kind of, one of them started smoking in the vestibule. Like, so like I found this stuff hilarious and like everybody else was like, not everybody else, like, it's whatever. You got to find whatever you thread you have to pull through.
Yeah, I think like the sometimes even just like the normalness of the rest of the world, stuff like that. It's just like people being people, but they continuing to be themselves in a context where you're expecting everyone to be like, you know, Grim Reaper is inherently very funny. That you're like smoking in the vestibule is insane.
In a hospital, yeah. So I guess that's, yeah, I look for it there. Yeah, I remember my mother and I were up late the night before my father's funeral, just talking about a lot of things like we did. And she was like really tired. And she was like, I'm sorry, I'm just so tired. We've been talking about this for a while. And I just started laughing. And she was like, what's so funny? I was like, well, you know, the expression like beating a dead horse. She was like, you cannot say that tomorrow. And then when my mom died, we had her cremated or whatever. We were looking at pictures one night and her urn was on the table, just like before, you know, like whatever, looking like you do, like for your fucking in memoriam. Oh my God, Kate was so beautiful. Oh my God, this is when we, you know, like that kind of shit. And we're sitting around eating,
yeah,
looking at these pictures and shit. And my buddy like tried to hand my brother a taco over the urn and fucking taco meat fell on my mother's urn.
No.
It's not even food to begin with. You know, so it's like, what? Just such a fucking, well, there's a comic named Dan Vitale. He had this joke that said, he said, you'd be surprised how much give the floor has when you hit bottom. It was like that. It was like the bench in Tommy Boy when he sits down after everything's gone wrong and the fucking, it breaks because he's so fat. It was like that, but it also made me laugh a lot.
Yeah, I think that's helpful to people because I think people who go through this kind of tragedies for the first time feel like they have to be sad all the time and feel guilty for finding those, you know, not even that they're looking for them, but just like coming across moments of levity, feel like I'm not supposed to smile during this ever.
That's not an issue. That was not an issue for me. Like I welcomed it because I knew I wasn't doing anything wrong.
Do you talk about grief and death in your work at all?
Yeah, a fair amount.
Does it help? Like, I guess what I mean is, do you do that because you think it's funny, which would be a good enough reason? Or do you do it also because you're trying to process it? Or do you do it because you're trying to help other people with it? Or, I don't know, maybe you don't even think about it that much. Maybe you just write great jokes.
In the sense of like, this is interesting. It's tough. Maybe I can really, because it resonates with me, maybe I can really write something very great about it. You know, like really funny. Because it's a real situation or a real thing I feel, as opposed to being like a Pottery Barn lift, love, laugh sign or whatever, you know, like,
yeah.
That's why I'll write about grief or a death or depression or any of that kind of stuff.
My last question, Shane, do you think of your parents as being somewhere now? Like, do you communicate with them in any way?
No, I don't.
Is it something that you thought right away? Like right away, it was like, they're dead, they're gone. Or is it something you can't, like, do you struggle with that thought at all, is what I mean?
It's a nice idea, but I would say it makes me, I just don't think there is. And it makes me more sad that I know I won't see or hear from them again than to hope that there is that thing.
You're saying the hope would make you more sad, or the finality makes...
I'm not seeing them now, right? Like anymore, they cease to exist.
Right.
So that is the feeling I have, and that's the real feeling I have.
Yeah.
And like, it's nice to think that there'd be a place for that where I could see them. But it's not real. Like, what I have right now is real. And that is loss. And I don't like that. And I, like, you know, like, it's not that I hope there's something like that. But I don't think it exists. You know, hope and belief are two fucking very different things.
Right.
So, no.
Okay, Shane. Thanks so much for doing this. This was A Good Cry with Shane Torres. Thanks for listening, and I hope it helps. Hey friends, me, Michael Cruz Kane again, urging you to share, subscribe, review, rate this episode if you haven't done it already, and to vote for us for the Webby Awards. We were nominated in the category of Best Episode of an Interview or Talk Show. It's the episode where I interview Stephen Colbert, episode 1, if you haven't listened to it yet. We are nominated for a People's Voice Award, and the link to vote for us is in the description of this episode. Vote if you can. If you can't, that's cool too. Hope you're having a good day, and see you next week. A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Edited and mixed by Caitlin Moldenhauer.
That was a HeadGum podcast.